Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining me today is my good friend, Dr. Mark Lewis, who is a longtime technologist, having served as the Air Force's chief scientist, including at the White House on the National Technology Council, and most recently did a stint in the Pentagon where he was trying to sort out some issues in the Research and Engineering Secretariat. He is now the executive director of the National Defense Industrial Association's Emerging Technologies Institute, and I can't imagine anybody better pioneering this new effort. Mark, thanks so very much for joining us.
Vago, thanks so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure, and I should have said among your many, many other laurels include being a faculty at the University of Maryland and also serving in a senior capacity at the American Institute for Aeronautics and Astronautics, one of the truly nation's truly great institutions. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our cyber coverage and our weekly cyber report. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology, which is very, very relevant today. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our coverage of air and missile defense. Mark, talk to us a little bit about the Technology Institute. Absolutely fascinating construct. I know that this is something that's really, really important to Hawk Carlisle, who leads NDIA. Talk to us a little bit about the Institute and what you guys are trying to accomplish.
Sure. Thanks, Vago. So very simply, the Emerging Technologies Institute was set up as a nonpartisan institute that's focused on this list of emerging technologies, these things that we think are critical for the nation's defense, especially looking to future capabilities. So ETI is going to be a research organization doing studies, reports, analyses, workshops, interacting with leaders in industry, interacting with leaders in government, but all focused on this idea that the American way of war it depends on technological superiority. And frankly, right now we're in a race. We've got peer competitors who are investing heavily, Russia and especially China. And if the U.S. is going to continue to be the dominant in national defense issues, it needs to be dominant in technology. And so that's what our institute is all about.
You guys are doing you mentioned workshops. You're about to do your first workshop. A date has been picked, so I'm glad we're not coming out of left field on this. And none other than Al Schaefer is going to be involved in it as well. Anybody who knows, he was the deputy, Ellen Lord's deputy in acquisition and sustainment. So as we were joking before this got started, right, the perfect kind of cooperation between ANS and R&E.
Well, yeah, Vago, absolutely. So, Al and I have been friends for, more decades than either of us would admit. And one of the pleasures that I found working on the E-ring this most recent round was working with Al almost on a daily basis. My joke was we wore a trough in the hallway on the E-ring between his office and my office. And so we're doing a workshop that's going to be discussing how do you modernize in an era where, you've got constraints, you've got budget constraints, you've got legacy platforms. How do you swap in the new when you're supporting the old? And we're going to look at it from a technology standpoint, look at it from a policy standpoint, and frankly, look at it from a legislative standpoint as well. So Al is going to be running a panel. I'll run a panel. And then we've asked the NDIA's amazing leader, Hawk Carlisle, to lead a panel as well. So it should be a fun time be had by all, and details will be forthcoming. But June 7th is our target date for that.
That would be really would be terrific, and very much looking forward to it. Is it all going to be online at this point? Right, we're sort of opening up. People are getting back to offices. Do you think there'll be an in person component to this, or is at this point is that still going to be a distance, a virtual event? Excuse me,
virtual. You're right. Things are starting to open up a bit, but we're not there yet. So this will be a virtual event.
Let me ask you. You were tapped to come in the department. Mike Griffin did personally and ask you to spearhead and help out with a whole series of technology issues. And you and I spoke a lot, and you were kind enough to spend quite a lot of time with us to talk a little bit about your portfolio and priorities. How do we need to think about the space that we're in, Mark, because, right, there's this ever American optimism, and some of it may be a little bit delusional, right? I mean, we're a country that always likes to tell ourselves, by golly, we're the best. But our adversaries have access to a lot of eye-watering technology. In fact, right, the proliferation of that technology can give even not very technologically advanced states a lot of capability, as we saw, for example, in the Azerbaijan-Armenia war, right? I mean, the best Turkish and Israeli technologies were on one side, completely changing the nature of the conflict and some asymmetric advantages, for example, that maybe the Armenian side thought that it had ultimately. How do we need to think about where we are in order to be able to generate the right outcomes? Because unless we're smart about it, we could double the defense budget to $1.5 trillion and we still won't get there.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, I like to say it very simply. We are in a race, and it's a race to technological superiority. So, you know, I remind people, and you go back to the early 1990s, the start of the Gulf War, the U.S. military unleashed new technology, precision-guided munitions, stealth technology. And frankly, the entire world stood back and said, holy crap. I mean, you think about what we did over the skies in Baghdad. It was absolutely amazing. Well, that was 3 decades ago. Like, the whole world has had an opportunity to study our game plan, study what we did there, study what we did in subsequent wars. And they've seen the impact of our technology. And they learn their lessons from us, and they've been preparing to match us. Russia somewhat, China especially. So we are in a race. You know, I spent a lot of time. I hang out with historians. I figure it's always a good idea to hang out with historians, that they always get the last word. And one of my very dear friends, Dick Hallion, who's former Air Force historian, likes to remind me that, you know, we won the technology war in a few instances, but we also lost it. And those lessons are important. You know, you think about, we invented the airplane, and then a little decade and a half later, we enter World War I, and we're not flying any of our own airplanes. We completely lost that technology. We're having to fly European airplanes. And there's a reason for that, and, you know, a lot of reasons for that, actually. Part of it was, after the Wright brothers invented the airplane, they sued anyone else who tried to do something similar. But the reality was, we kind of lost the ball on that. And we were even late in starting up our own air force as a separate service. Other countries have done that before that. The jet engine, another example. We completely dropped the ball on jet engines. In the late 1930s, we started studying jet engine technology. We heard about work that was going on in England. We didn't know about the work at the time going on in Germany. But we had panels that studied this stuff and concluded there was nothing to the jet engine. It had no obvious applications. And meanwhile, you have European nations running with it. And so the Germans are introducing jet-powered aircraft at the end of World War II that airplanes couldn't match. Fortunately, by that time, they'd run out of good pilots. Otherwise, it might have been a sobering capability. So we have these examples where we thought we were technologically superior and we dropped the ball. Fortunately, most of the cases, we were able to play catch-up pretty quickly. I think we're at risk of being in a similar situation, right? Just as we invented the airplane. So, you know, we invented hypersonics, you know, a passion of mine. And now we're seeing other nations, and in particular, China, that has taken what we've learned. They basically stole our homework, and they're moving faster than we are. And that puts us at significant risk.
Well, right. I mean, they stole quite a lot, right? But we as an open society also make available the scientific papers, and NASA publishes all of that data with extraordinary fidelity, in part because it's a sort of, hey, we're going to help mankind improve. You know, to your point about organizational, right? I mean, at the end of the day, the biggest enemy is thinking. Had the United States just listened to Wernher von Braun and used his Jupiter C, we could have put a satellite in orbit before the Russians did. But ultimately, President Eisenhower didn't want the Germans launching the satellite. He wanted Americans launching the satellite on the all-American Vanguard rocket. And we saw how that, you know, and eventually we were in January, January 1958, right? It was Wernher von Braun's Jupiter C with an explorer on the top of it that made it into orbit anyway.
And you know, Vago, that's a great example too, because, you know, it's often been pointed out that one of the reasons that we didn't launch when we could have launched was, well, there was no requirement for it. And so, you know, you got von Braun sitting down at the Redstone Arsenal ready to go, but no one had a requirement for his system. And I like to think that's one of the reasons that we got smart and we created organizations like DARPA, which does technology, what, frankly, without a requirement, right? You know, there's got to be this balance between requirements pull, but also technology push. You had Von Braun trying to push the technology and no one was listening. So we need two sides of those equations. And that's something also that I think we're going to be picking up in the Emerging Technologies Institute, that balance between requirements, you know, requirements pull and technology push.
You know, when you're in the organization, it's very, very hard, obviously, for anybody, you included. I mean, you really have always prided yourself on being open and communicative, and I believe you were so. But at the same time, you know, you have to advocate for the organization itself. We now have a new administration. They're making a priority of doing trade-offs. This is going to be ugly and awkward, I think, right? Because at the end of the day, in $753 billion can get you even more defense than we're getting if we made some choices, some informed choices, and perhaps, as you said at the very start of this, right, let go of some legacy capabilities to field the leap-ahead capabilities we're going to need. The Bush administration tried to do that as well, right? And everybody said, you know, and of course 9/11 happened, and we couldn't do the sort of skip a generation thing. What are the most important areas, Mark, that we need to have national focus on to advance? Quantum is important. There is no national quantum strategy. AI is important. There's maybe a nascent, right, but no AI strategy. Hypersonics was still fragmented. One of the roles you came in was to bring more shape to that and not have it be as laissez-faire. What are the areas where we're going to need some, not a heavy hand, but a steering hand to focus, build strategies that are really the most leap ahead areas?
So Vago, you know, I think you're exactly right. At the end of the day, one of the biggest challenges facing us is, frankly, the competition between investing in new things and then the legacy systems that we've already invested in, that we're already building, that we're already sustaining. That's the challenge. And how do you balance those out? And look, it's just human nature. You've got bills to pay today. So you put off saving, you put off investing in the future if you've got bills to pay today. So that's one of the things that we have to watch. That's something that we certainly championed when I was in the building. And obviously I'm hopeful that the incoming administration also has that view. But you know, if you step back, so the Department of Defense, let's not forget, Department of Defense has a pretty robust research and engineering investment portfolio. Robust in terms of topics being covered, also robust in terms of dollars amount. I mean, we're talking more than $100 billion a year being spent in RDT&E. The number's approximate, it's, you know, a little bit fuzzy on the outskirts, but that's three times the investment we make in National Institute of Health. It's almost an order of magnitude, more than an order of magnitude, more than we invest at National Science Foundation. So there is a lot of money going into these technology areas. So in my mind, it's not just the question of the total dollar amount, although, you know, you always obviously want to have sufficient investment. It's also what you invest in. And that's why I love your question, because, you know, you've got to spend your money wisely. And so, you know, when you ask, what are the areas? So, you know, when I walked in the Pentagon, I inherited a list of 11 technology areas that Mike Griffin handed me. And those came out of the National Defense Strategy. And, you know, I frequently said, I didn't come up with this list, but if you asked me to come up with a list, that's probably the list I would have come up with. Right. And frankly, they're the common sense areas, all right? It's artificial intelligence, it's cyber, it's communications, fully network command control, it's autonomy. Then, you know, obviously hypersonics, my own personal passion, mostly passion. You know, that I see as being absolutely critical. Hypersonics, why is that so important? Very simply, every time we wargamed future conflicts with that hypersonics, we lost. So we needed to have it in the mix. Directed energy, space, but you know, now you mentioned quantum, you mentioned biotechnology. So those, again, those are a little bit further reaching. You know, I will tell you, I think last time we chatted, I told you that when I first showed up in the Pentagon, I tell everyone that, you know, biotechnology is important. And the response I'd get is, yeah, we know it's important, but it's not what we do. I mean, the services didn't view their role as biotechnology. Then the pandemic hit and everyone realized, ooh, maybe this biotechnology stuff is important after all. And, you know, we got some success stories. You trace back some of the development, for example, of the COVID vaccines. You can trace it back to some investments at DARPA. So those areas across the board, you know, I was You know, when I was in the building, I highlighted microelectronics as being my top priority. Hypersonics is number two. As an aside, when we made the announcement that microelectronics was now number one, I can't tell you the number of phone calls I started getting, like, oh, so you don't care about hypersonics anymore. Said, no, we still care about hypersonics.
Exactly.
It's still important. Yes. So, you know, they're all kind of important. But if I can, let me come back to the point of it's important how you invest your money. And you mentioned hypersonics. When I walked into the building, there were a lot of investments being made. The services had fully embraced it. Army, Navy, Air Force had activities, but honestly, they weren't well coordinated. And if I look back, one of the successes we had in R&E, and I tip my hat to Mike White, because he put together this roadmap that kind of pulled the services together and got them cooperating and collaborating and interacting. You look at something like quantum. So the biggest problem you got in quantum is there's a lot of hype. There are a lot of people claiming that quantum is going to change computing tomorrow, and it's going to revolutionize cryptography and communications and radar and the internet. And you know, there's a pretty low signal to noise ratio in some of that. And the frustrating thing is there are some really important things we need to invest in, you know, in quantum, for example, quantum sensors, position, navigation, timing using quantum systems, really important, low hanging fruit. Could have significant impact, and so it's a matter of focusing where we invest, not just how much we invest. That I really worry about.
Let me ask you about right. I mean, for decades, and so the Pentagon used to be very, very good at identifying commercial technologies, bringing it into the military, and militarizing it. Right. It was only after World War II that military development began leading everything and leading to the internet and communications gains and computing and everything else. Whereas the historical way of doing this is very vibrant commercial industry, and the Pentagon would jump on there with some exceptions, right? In this era, we have so many commercial developments that the speed of those commercial developments are outpacing what it is that the classical defense industry or defense industrial base can do. Not to say that it's not important, but How do we better harness these commercial cycles? Because some of the commercial contractors can be extremely cooperative and very, very eager to do business and expand. You know, I dare say, I would say our sponsor, General Motors Defense, is one of those commercial companies that were a massive, you know, were arsenal of democracy, got out of the defense business after the end of the Cold War, and now have been increasingly saying, hey, we really have some great technology we're working. Let's get back into the defense game, whether it's on battery or electrics or autonomy or any of those, you know, vehicular technology. And then you've got sort of big tech, and big tech is cooperative to a degree, right? How do we need to think about the ecosystem so that the Mark Lewis that's sitting in the Pentagon has access to what they need and doesn't get pushback from heritage companies that look at some of these new and innovative ideas as genuine threats to their franchises, right? I mean, how's the way to do this to get what we need when we need it, the way we need it?
Yeah. So, you know, so Vago, your question is so well posed. You know, the Pentagon now is looking at weapon cycle timelines in the order of decades. And meanwhile, you've got, you know, parts of the industry. You know, just look at software. They measure cycle times in months or weeks. So it's as we say in engineering circles, an impedance mismatch. So often I think people look for a legislative solution. You know, what new laws, what new processes can we create? And I don't think we need to create any. We would find that we had all the mechanisms in place, the legal mechanisms in place to do things quickly, to be responsive, to harness the best of commercial. An example of that, the Space Development Agency, led by the rather amazing Derek Tournier. So Derek's mission is to field things in space as fast as possible. He's trying to build this proliferated LEO constellation. He went from an industry day to contract award in record time without breaking any laws, without getting any new authorities. He didn't even use an OTA, other transactional authority. So the mechanisms are all already in place. I actually think it's cultural. I think it's cultural mindset. It's the mindset of the folks who are awarding contracts, who are doing, you know, the folks who are leading these efforts, the organizations that do the, you know, do the paperwork. It's infusing a culture of moving quickly, removing barriers. You know, I before I joined the Pentagon, I was involved in a review of a Pentagon agency, and we discovered that in a lot of their decisions, you know, there were they had a program where there are 24 people who could say no, but only 2 people who could say yes. And so one thing you do is you set up your organization so you only get to say no if you can also say yes, right? That's one thing you do. I think we've also seen some wonderful examples of, you know, innovative organizations. They're small, they're experimental, but organizations that have proven this. I mentioned the Space Development Agency. I'm obviously a big fan. AFWERX, DIU. So DIU has, you know, shown that they can work well with companies. And to that point, I'm absolutely delighted that my friend Michael Brown is now coming in to lead ANS. I talk about a person who can bring in a culture change to the acquisition community. If anyone can do that, Michael Brown can. So that's really kind of exciting. But again, I'll get back to it's rewarding the right behaviors and creating that culture shift. It's not necessarily creating new laws or new legislation. If I can, there's another element too, which is, you know, if you look at the vast resources that American industry still has to deploy, you know, we want them to work. We want companies to work with the department, and that means we need to make it easy for them. Especially true for small businesses. I can't tell you how many small businesses would tell me, you know, we want to engage with the Department of Defense, but it's a 6-month to a year timeline before from white paper to contract. We're a small company. We can't survive that. Or I'll have companies tell me, we want to work with you, but as soon as we try to sell you something, you want to make sure that we can't sell to any other partners. and you're a small piece of our business. So why would we do that? So understanding the motivations of our industry partners, understanding how to engage them, understanding what their concerns are. I think that's absolutely critical.
How do one last question, right? I mean, so everybody though talks about the importance of, you know, incentives, and this is how we have to change it, and people should do this. Is it historically we've proven to be most successful when we've had smaller, leaner organizations and lower ranking people having more authority, right? I mean, so if you look at the and I apologize for our audience, they've heard this before. Sonny Maria, who was the F1 engine program manager on the Saturn V to put man on the moon, was something like 27 or 28 years old. He was very, very experienced and had worked on a lot of engine technology because he was a prodigy, was down in Huntsville, came to von Braun's attention. But I think people have a tendency of forgetting that. And we have, but you know, people now don't work on as many programs, unless maybe if you were at SpaceX, for example, where you would have worked on a lot of programs, right? I mean, now it's like, you know, veteran engineers are exhausted by working on F-35, where they'll spend their whole career on it. A friend of mine got out because he was like, if I did one more drop tank test on another combat aircraft program, he was like, I was going to quit on the spot. How do you tighten these organizations, shorten the spans of control to make them more efficient and have more powerful chiefs, maybe?
So great question. And it comes back to culture. And I actually hate to say it, but I think it ultimately comes back to leadership. So you know, I often laugh. The best leadership examples that I ever learned were as a university professor. That was my management training. Because what are the keys to be successful as a university professor? Well, professors get measured on their research output. And how do you do research output? Very simply, you find really smart students. So you recruit and you attract the best students you can. You kind of help them get started on a thesis project. You run interference for them when they hit obstacles. And then you get the hell out of the way and you let them do their research. And when you do your job right, your student is more expert in that in their subject area than you are. And that's considered success. I think we need to get that same sense across the department. You know, I love your example, the F1 engine. One of the more interesting conference sessions that I ever attended, when I was president of AIAA, we did a session celebrating the anniversary of Apollo. And I forgot exactly what year it was. We had a panel of former Apollo program managers. And someone asked the panel, what were the ultimate keys to success of the Apollo program? And they came up with 2 answers. One is they had a 100% management reserve. So, okay, those days are over. We're not going there. But number 2, the average age of an engineer working on Apollo was late 20s, and the average age of a program manager, early 30s. And they were given full authority. One of the folks on the panel was telling this story. I think it was Arnie Aldrich, a real good, real dear friend. Arnie told a story about, you know, they had the Apollo 13 accident. The NASA administrator comes down. He meets with the team. He's the oldest guy in the room. I mean, this is a team of engineers who are in their 20s and early 30s. And instead of marching in as the leader saying, okay, I'm in charge now, he walked in and said, what do you guys need from me? You're in charge. And that's the philosophy that I think we need to infuse. I hate to say it, it comes from the top. It comes from leadership at the top. It comes from leaders empowering their people, telling them you're in charge. And by the way, it also means you tolerate mistakes. I mean, you know, I when I was on the Air Staff, so General Moseley, Buzz Moseley, used to give us boxes of books to read. It was great. When we do retreats, we had these deep philosophical discussions. Right. Really fun time. And one of the books that he had us read was 1776, the David McCullough book about George Washington. And,
right.
And one of the things that Buzz emphasized was every single one of Washington's military leaders made a profound mistake at some point in the war. Right. All right. And instead of being fired, they were told to learn from their mistake and move on. And that's nowadays, mistakes are fatal. You screw up once and you're out. You know, it's funny to me. Every significant Navy leader in World War II had run a ship aground at some point in his career. Right. Nowadays, you run your ship aground in the Navy, you're out. You're cashier. Of course, in principle, it's harder to run a ship aground these days. But still, the point, we don't tolerate mistakes, and we don't let people learn from their mistakes. And infusing that culture, again, the only way I know how to do it is it comes from the top.
Mark, thanks so very much. It's always an honor and pleasure talking to you. Really appreciate it. You're welcome to join us anytime, and would love to be able to do that. Good luck on the new institute and certainly in all the prep for the workshop. Thanks so much for joining us.
Vago, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.